It's December 6th, Thursday morning. We're learning, of course, Theodicy and Providence in post-Holocaust literature. We studied at the beginning of this year the writings of Professor Eliezer Berkovits, Faith After the Holocaust, and then we had one class on Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, Breaking the Tablets. That was last week. And now we're beginning with Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. I'll say just one or two sentences, perhaps five or six, perhaps even ten, about Rav Yitz, and then we'll actually read what we're going to study. Rav Yitz was born in the States, in the New York area, in 1933, and he's been active, say, since then in Jewish education and Jewish thought. He was trained as a modern Orthodox rabbi at Yeshiva University, and got his PhD in history. He's been a historian. He's been a Holocaust researcher. He's been very involved in Holocaust education in the U.S. He was involved in the Holocaust Museum in Washington. Some people know. He's been a modern Orthodox rabbi in Riverdale in the Bronx. He's spent time teaching at many different universities. And he's the founder of KLAL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, right? He's worked with the Steinhardt Foundation also in New York, and at this point he's trying to spend this decade of his life in research and in writing. Many people in Dallas have had the opportunity to meet him because he's been here more than once, years before I was in Dallas. I know that Janice Sweet and her husband, Arnie, peace be on his soul, they were very close to him, as well as other people. January something.
Yeah.
January. Be here at Anshei Torah, and I unfortunately won't be here, but it's certainly a wonderful opportunity to go in here
January
and speak.
January the 17th, 18th.
Right, that rings a bell at Anshei Torah. That's really important.
Who this guy is?
Yeah.
Rev. Greenberg.
He's great. He's really terrific.
I'll also add that Rav Yitz has been a personal mentor to me in the past few years. I got to know him through his nephew. His nephew is a friend of mine in Israel. His nephew, Rabbi Natan Greenberg, was my friend, colleague, and employer. Rav Natan is the founder of the Bat Ayin Yeshiva, which is a modern, pluralistic, Hasidic yeshiva. Nothing like it. Doesn't exist anymore in Israel.
Litvisha Hasidim.
Yeah. Modern Litvisha pluralistic Hasidim. Rav Yitz used to come once or twice a year to support us, to teach us, and he also did an awful lot in fundraising in the U.S. to keep the yeshiva alive. I got to know him there. And today, in addition to the million other things that Rav Yitz does, I can't keep track of him, he is a member of the International Rabbinical Fellowship, which is a small group of about 150 modern Orthodox rabbis that grew as a counterpoint to the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the main body of modern Orthodox rabbis. This body, the IRF, the International Rabbinical Fellowship, is representative of open orthodoxy, more liberal, if you will, modern orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy. And Rav Yitz joins in the conversations on our listserv almost every day, and it's always a great source of inspiration just to correspond with him. So here we go. Rav Yitz, just to tell you, wrote a number of books. You can read his book, The Jewish Way, which is on the holidays. A very eye-opening and refreshing view of the Jewish holidays, The Jewish Way. He wrote a book that's a collection of his essays called For the Sake of Heaven and Earth, which is a collection of his essays on Jewish-Christian relations. There's also a book that's a set of interviews with him. I think it's called In the Divine Image, or In the Image of God. What we're about to learn is a set of three essays that has not been formally published, or if it was published once, it's out of print. I have it here simply as a reprint that was done by KLAL. It's called Perspectives is the name of the series, and this is a set of three essays, one called The Third Great Cycle of Jewish History, the other Voluntary Covenant, and then The Third Era of Jewish History, Power and Politics. We're going to concentrate on the first two essays. What I've put aside here is the first one of three. As I have in my hand all three of them, you have in your hands just the first one. And I will photostat the second when we get there. We're going to study most of this, not all of it. I have brackets there to show the small parts that we're going to leave out. Let's just read it and begin trying to understand. Everyone see the beginning? So, Aaron, I don't have another copy.
I saw that.
Don't have another copy.
Right.
So you can, if you want to look on, you can.
Just go ahead and
start. Judaism is a midrash on history. That already is an important statement.
I'm trying to understand that.
And all of Judaism is an effort to interpret history. He'll explain why it's like that, but it is. Remember that Judaism, unlike Christianity, is not about salvation of the soul. It's not about any future world. It's really not about God. It's about human life as we're taught by God, perhaps directed by God, but it's about human life as unfolding on earth. And therefore, what happens in human history is the center of what Judaism is. And all of our theology should be an effort to interpret history, an interpretation of history. We don't know God like the Greeks as the unmoved mover, as the result of rational speculation. That's not the way we know God. We know God in history. What we know of God comes from our interpretation of history. And therefore, the point is going to be that every historical event should affect Judaism, should affect our midrash, should affect our understanding of where we're going and what we're doing and what God is. Ultimately, his point is going to be that there have been three great revelations, I should say three great periods of revelation in Jewish history. The first is the biblical revelation of the Exodus and Sinai. The second is the revelation of the destruction of the Second Temple. When I say revelation, I mean historical events that fundamentally alter our understanding of humanity in God's world, of history. So the first revelation was Exodus and Sinai. The second revelation was the destruction of the Second Temple. And the third revelation is the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. And he's going to tell us that our understanding of what human life is, that is to say, what Judaism is, and certainly our understanding of God's relationship and role in human life, at every revelation, that understanding changes. And today, we are trying to assimilate, absorb, understand the meaning of the third great set of revelations in Jewish history, the Holocaust and the State of Israel's birth. We're still in the process of trying to figure out what it means. And if we continue to live and think as Jews today in the same fashion that we did before these revelations, then we didn't get it and we're not really Jews. Because to be a Jew is to understand life in light of
history.
So we have to interpret, we have to make an effort to interpret and to live in the light of, in the wake of, these sets of revelations that happened in our lifetime. So here we go. Oh, and of course you might ask, okay, that's beautiful. What does it have to do with our class on theodicy and providence? It has everything to do with it, because we will interpret and reinterpret and re-understand providence, God's relationship to the world, on the basis of what happens in the world. There's no other way to know except by seeing what happens. It's very empirical. It's not rational. It's not based on our understanding of what God is or should be. It's based on understanding of what actually is happening in the world. So Judaism is a midrash in history. Its fundamental assertion is that human life and history are rooted in the divine, an infinite source of life and goodness. History, therefore, is moving towards final perfection. If it's created by God, if it's all about God, and if God is perfect, then there's an automatic assumption that the purpose of it all is to move towards perfection. At the end, human life, that is to say, to move towards God. At the end, human life will be redeemed and every human will attain his or her fullest expression as a creature created in the image of God. In that age, the infinite value, equality, and uniqueness of every human being will be upheld by the socio-economic realities of the world. There will be no oppression or exploitation. There will be adequate resources to take care of every single life appropriately. The physical, emotional, and relational aspects of the individual's life will be perfected. Judaism dreams that life will win out. That life will win out. So that eventually even sickness and death will be overcome. Judaism affirms that this incredible perfection will be attained in this world in actual human history. God, the ultimate source of life and energy, has made that promise. In return, the Jews pledge to live their lives in obedience to the divine mandate and as witnesses to the promised final perfection. This mutual pledge constitutes the covenant of the Jewish people, that we are part of moving the world towards God, which means towards perfection. We're not defining what perfection means completely.
This is a very distinct description of what we said could not exist if we had free will. So this says perfection at the time of perfection.
I've had that discussion with Rav Yitz.
Not necessarily so in Yitz Greenberg's view. I don't know where Yitz will come out because I've just heard the first paragraph of a very long essay. But that's what the other two guys thought.
Yeah. It's a good point. Let's put it on the table and go on.
Okay.
How does this differ from Darwinism?
Darwin doesn't think of any perfection in the...
eventually, with Darwinism, theoretically, you should get perfection.
Mm.
Perfection.
No. Evolution, not perfection.
It's just survival of the fittest.
It's just an adaptation.
Like messianic era.
It's an adaptation. Evolution really deals with who adapts in order to survive in a certain environment?
You're right that there is a great affinity between Darwinism and covenantal Judaism in the sense that they both see change as the essence of reality.
Well, Rabbi Sachs, I thought, put it beautifully. It says evolution is a continuation of creation. That's what he said last week.
Mm-hmm. But Darwinism, evolution, at least as we hear it on the airwaves, is not directed. Doesn't have a goal. Whereas the evolution that Rav Yitz is talking about has a goal. It's moving towards God's perfection. Now, I will just say that Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook did indeed take Darwinism, interpret it as synonymous with Jewish movement towards covenantal perfection. Rabbi Cook said that Darwin discovered the greatest principle of Jewish mysticism. He just left out one detail, that evolution is directed.
It seems like that's really, you're talking about power history, is the essence of Darwinism.
Power history, right, and this is history.
Did you see any evidence that we're making progress toward that goal?
Let's read on. Good question. The meaning of redemption that is central to Jewish tradition grew out of and is validated by an event in Jewish history, the Exodus, the freeing of the Hebrew slaves from bondage in Egypt. The lessons of the Exodus, that there is a redeeming God, that human power is not absolute and will not be permitted to oppress people indefinitely, and that freedom and dignity are the inherent rights of all individuals, will be universalized. That message will be universalized at the outset of the Messianic Age, which will be the culmination of history. Judaism has been guided by the Exodus as its orienting event since biblical times. This orientation has set the basic direction, goal, and operating methods of Judaism in history. Since the religion is committed to the proposition that the final realization of the Exodus will take place in actual history and not in some other world or reality, the credibility and persuasive power of the promise of redemption rises and falls under the impact of historical events. Right? If we believe, because we saw it happen in history, that God intervenes on the side of the oppressed, that God improves human life, that God gives justice. Okay, if that doesn't happen for a million years, then we better reinterpret our history. We better reinterpret what we believe. So again, the credibility and persuasive power of the promise of redemption rises and falls under the impact of historical events. History apparently confirms or denies the basic Jewish teaching, right? If you believe that religion is all about the redemption of the soul in the afterlife, then nothing that happens on this earth can confirm or deny your beliefs. And then this world becomes just a stepping stone or a corridor to what's really important. But Judaism, not so. Judaism says it's this world that's important. And this world is all about what we learned from the Exodus, the move towards redemption. So if it doesn't happen for a million years, something's wrong. And you have to reinterpret and recalibrate your paradigm.
Does it show any signs of happening?
That's what we're reading. And if it doesn't, we have to reinterpret.
Right now.
Again, that's why we're reading this. That's why we're reading it. Jewish triumphs or rescues from evil traditionally have been perceived as confirmations of the promise of history, right? The promise of history as we interpret it from the Exodus. Occasionally, historical events were of such magnitude that they profoundly affected the understanding of the central model. One could not go on affirming the central message without taking the new event into account. It happened in the past. As I hinted 5 minutes ago, it happened in the past with the destruction of the Second Temple. The paradigm was profoundly altered, as we will see. That's the subject of the essay. And he's going to go on to say that the paradigm, meaning how we understand God and history, has to be profoundly altered after the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. Such events became orienting events themselves and were incorporated into the religion and the way of life of the Jewish people. Why should the vicissitudes of Jewish history affect divine teaching so much? According to the Bible, the Jewish people are the carriers of the message of redemption to the world. This people models moments of perfection, testifies to the future redemption, and witnesses to the divine concern and presence which will bring it all about. Because God is infinite and beyond human comprehension, the news of God's premise and promise is communicated through the Jewish people to the world. Therefore, the persuasiveness of the message is directly correlated to Jewish existence and Jewish life. Right? If he's saying if God has a message that ultimately he's going to bring ultimate redemption to the world as a whole, and we understand that Jewish people are his chosen people, well, if in Jewish life we don't see God's presence, we don't see that redemption unfolding, then something is wrong and something has to be reinterpreted. That's what he meant when he said, therefore, the persuasiveness of the message to the world is directly correlated to Jewish existence and Jewish life. The ultimate message of the infinite has been turned over to a flesh and blood people to deliver to others and to incarnate in its own life. While Jewish sociology and Jewish theology are not identical, they are profoundly interrelated. Again, which means what happens to the Jewish people has to teach something to us about Jewish theology, about God. So we're going to stop here. It's all important, but can't read it all. We're going to stop here and read just one quarter of a paragraph on page 2. You should see the brackets on the right-hand side of page 2 near the bottom. And this is just a recapitulation. Out of the Exodus, directly and through interpretation, by revelation and by generalization comes the teachings which revolutionize Jewish faith and humanity's history. Central to biblical thought is the idea that there's an ultimate power that cares about humanity. Mm-hmm. Where do we get that idea? From the Exodus. That there is a fundamental right to human freedom and dignity. Where do we get that from? From the Exodus. That the covenant makes the divine commandments binding on both ruler and ruled. And that there are basic laws by which human behavior should be guided as exemplified in the Ten Commandments. We learn that from history. From history playing out itself. On page 3, on the left-hand side, there's a paragraph in brackets. The great internal struggle of the biblical era, the whole period of the first monarchy and David and Solomon and later, lay in coping with the challenge of Jewish sovereignty and statehood while trying to live up to covenantal values. In other words, the clash between values on the one hand and reality on the other hand. The land of Israel was located at a highly strategic crossroads of the world along the invasion routes between Europe, Asia, and Africa. Thus, every world empire sooner or later marched its armies on the road to Jerusalem. The vulnerability and fragility of Jewish existence in the land was exacerbated by the relatively small Jewish population and the continual magnetism of foreign cultures. International pressure made a central ruler an inescapable necessity, so that the monarchy was instituted over the opposition of tribal loyalties, religious objections, and other centrifugal forces. But the monarchs and ruling classes into whose hands Jewish fate was consigned were continually forced or drawn into active contact with outside powers, which only increased the cultural vulnerability of the Hebrew religion. It was difficult to live up to covenantal values of dignity for the weak or freedom for Hebrew slaves, learn those values from the Exodus, when comfort, power, and the need for defense conspired to legitimize self-interest and the rule of might makes right. The dialectic of power and covenantal values was fought out in confrontations between prophets and kings, even as the need for legitimacy and religious guidance unified kings, prophets, and court prophets. In other words, the Jewish people are always trying to implement and apply in the world the values we learn from history, the Exodus, of human dignity and freedom, and living in the shadow of God. We're trying to implement those ideas in the reality of politics. Page 3, in the middle of a paragraph, I have a bracket, almost the middle of the page. In the biblical period, the prophets did not by and large succeed with the masses. But the prophets again and again failed. They spoke of values, they spoke of justice, they spoke of freeing the poor from the bonds of oppression, and they didn't succeed. Their uncompromising demands coming from a source beyond the people, from God, were too far away from the equivocal realities of everyday life. You understand what he's saying? The prophets were on high, preaching for justice, preaching to let the slaves go, let the poor live in dignity, and it just didn't penetrate to the masses. It was too far away, and it wasn't relevant to their lives, because their lives were trying to make a living, trying to defend the Jewish state from the onslaughts of foreign powers, and it was just difficult to live a life of values. They didn't succeed. Later, the rabbis, and now he is foreshadowing what he's going to say later, the rabbis, operating out of the people's realities, compromised and improved matters step by step. They made a plan, beginning from the grassroots, how to implement values. They didn't just preach from on high. It wasn't just God talking out of the prophet. It was human beings who know human beings. No human society, no politics. They educated the people and finally uplifted them to the point where they accepted the prophets as normative and saw prophetic ethics as within reach. Now, what that means is that when the prophet spoke 3,000 years ago, they were ridiculed. They weren't accepted. It's only later in history, when the rabbis implemented the prophetic values by their step-by-step plans for changing slowly human behavior, only after we reach the sense of identification with the values of the prophets do we go back and respect the prophets. But they weren't respected in their own time.
Well, that raises a question of just interpretation. And that is, did the rabbis implement the values, or did they interpret the values so that the people could understand them and hopefully accept them?
Both. I mean,
there's a difference.
Right. But it's certainly also both.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you always interpret both?
During the biblical era, the covenantal relationship itself was marked by a high degree of divine intervention. Here we're getting closer to our topic. God's manifest presence in the temple was the cultic counterpart of prophecy. Right? There was prophets, there was miracles, and there was God's presence in the temple. Even as God spoke directly to Israel through prophets, so at Jerusalem the vine could be contacted. So all of this, miracles, prophecy, God's presence in the temple, didn't work to help the people absorb and live by these values. Sounds great, right? God everywhere. Didn't work. The awe and... Say it again?
One exception with Jonah speaking to the Gentiles.
Right. Right. The awe and power of the place, that is to say the temple, demanded the Israelites go through careful ritual purification before entering. Unauthorized encounters with a divine presence led to instant death. The same overt divine intervention expressed itself in the events of biblical history. When Israel obeyed, the Lord is victorious. When it strayed, it was defeated. Defeat itself was the best proof that disobedience had taken place. Thus, the setback to Joshua's invading army at Ai, coming as it did after the great victory at Jericho, was quickly traceable to the sacrilegious taking of booty by a man named Achan, beginning of the book of Joshua. Stand and see the salvation of the Lord, said Moses. God will fight for you and you will hold your peace. These words precede the splitting of the Red Sea, the triumphal moment of the Exodus, when divine power finally and completely shattered power's human might, underscoring the ultimate weakness and relativity of all human power. This overwhelming divine might was the best proof of God's presence and God's existence. Human power denied God's might and got crushed. At this moment of divine triumph, God saw the great hand, feared the Lord, and believed. The covenant may be a partnership, but it's very clear that God is the initiator, the senior partner, who punishes, rewards, and enforces the partnership if the Jews slacken. That's the way it was, or the way it was interpreted in the biblical period, that God is the senior partner. And the hint is, that's going to change. That's going to change. That's the way it used to be. In the stinging words of Isaiah,
Ezekiel.
Thank you, Ezekiel. You say, we will be as the nations. Whereas the Jews want to be like the nations. As I live, says the Lord, with a strong hand and outstretched arm and with poured out fury, I will rule over you. God's in charge, directly in the biblical period. Miracles, prophecy, presence in the temple. In sum, during the biblical period, the way of redemption is marked by a growing sense of mission. Both manifest divinity and holiness are expressed in cult and prophecy. Cult means the temple. The primary institutions of temple, priests, and prophets in the Jewish leadership reflect the active intervention of the divine in Jewish life, as well as the struggle to live with the tensions between the covenant and real politic. This entire complex was first challenged and then transformed in the aftermath of the temple's destruction and the people of Israel's exile. In other words, that understanding of history that we just described is going to change, because the Jews perceived with the destruction of the Second Temple that history changed. And the conclusion that Jews are going to reach in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple, the conclusion Jews are going to reach is that God is altering his relationship to the world.
What about history in areas that are far remote from Jews? Like Chinese civilization, Japanese, Far Eastern. You know, does Greenberg feel that what happens in Jewish history affects how he relates to those histories of those areas that are so remote from Jewish history?
Great question.
Right. Yitz Greenberg is interesting in this respect. He was involved in a series of discussions with the Dalai Lama.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
So
wow.
He understands Eastern religion very well, at least Buddhism,
wow.
Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, he's encountered it. He doesn't understand it.
No. Well, he's encountered it, but there were in-depth discussions.
Yeah, there were in-depth discussions.
Was, you know.
The Dalai Lama wanted to.
So I don't know the answer to your question, but it's a very important question.
Sure.
That was a meeting, and there is a book about it. It's called The Jew in the Lotus.
Yeah.
Right.
And the Dalai Lama wanted to know why, how Jewish people survived being out of the, of their country when he was displaced from
China.
Tibet.
Right.
So Yitz was there, and also his wife, and different type of rabbis.
Yeah.
And they discussed that.
On to this. We're talking about this major era or time period where we had these changes. What was different about the second destruction of the temple and the first destruction? Why did this not start or take place at this evolutionary process, pardon my Darwinism, take place at the first destruction of the temple?
You're right. And he's actually going to say that it did.
Oh, okay.
That it began the destruction of the first temple, but only fully flowered the destruction of the second temple. In other words, it took 600 years
process.
Okay. To process.
But it did. Okay.
Yes, he's so absolutely going to say that.
There was no difference other than it hadn't had time to mature.
Right, but there's a difference between the two. That was it Cyrus? Was it Cyrus that allowed them to return back 70 years later?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they
yes.
were allowed to rebuild. Second temple was destroyed. Rome made it clear that was it.
And there was a rebirth of, yes. of Jewish. With all those rabbis that went to Yavne, that they saved Judaism, really, because it became rabbinic Judaim.
Exactly, right? They
so
saved it and transformed
it. Second disruption of the first.
Okay.
And it's
transformed. I forget the name, the author of Breaking the Tablets, said that the destruction of the Jewish temple was not a structural collapse. And so here, I guess Greenberg is presenting a
good, 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 Chip. Good point. That's a very good point. Yeah.
I keep bringing this up, but the destruction of the Second Temple was not part, did not destroy the Jewish people. It was spark off the revolt because the Jews survived for another 70 years. And then after Bar Kokhba revolt, you know, the word was at least 2 to 3 million Jews were killed at that point in time.
Right.
So that's what really destroyed the Jewish people and caused them to go into the diaspora.
Right, and that's what caused us to realize that there is, it's a new time. Right.
But it was not just the destruction. So why does everybody talk about the Second Temple and ignore the Bar Kokhba revolt, which really destroyed the Jewish people?
Well, that's a good
point.
We lost the culture.
Right. He's going to mention that a bit.
All right.
Let me just mention, to relate to this whole subject, with the return of the exiles from the 70 years of Babylonian exile to the land of Israel, the rebuilding of the temple, if you read the prophetic works of that time, Zechariah, Malachi,
Haggai,
you see the hope that the clock has been turned back and we're still in the biblical period. They're waiting for God to show his hand, and it doesn't happen. And then if you read the books of the Maccabees, about the year 167 before the Common Era, you see they're waiting for God to show his hand. And when it doesn't happen, there's great confusion. And that's the beginning of, that's part of the process of reinterpreting the world we live in. But the full culmination of that didn't happen until the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, when it became clear, God's out of here. God's not going to intervene. We better get prepared for a long exile in which the fundamental assumptions are different. So we're reading now the new section, the rabbinic era. The destruction of the Second Temple and the succeedingly crushing defeats of the Jews in 70 and 135 CE. 135 CE, that's Bar Kokhba. Page 4. Just where we left off. So the destruction of the Second Temple and the succeeding crushing defeats of the Jews in 70 and 135 CE after the wars that bled Judah white generated a major crisis of faith and meaning in the Jewish people. The massive loss of life, the sale of tens of thousands of Jews into slavery, and the triumph of Rome despite the conviction of Jewish zealots that God alone should rule Israel, deepened the questions, was there not God? Had God been overpowered by the Roman gods? Had God rejected the covenant with Israel and allowed his people and holy temple to be destroyed? Were the traditional channels of divine love, forgiveness, and blessing now closed to the Jewish people? Today, it is hard to recapture the monumental importance of those questions in the first century of the Common Era. It is now 1,900 years after the rabbis resolved the crisis of faith that followed the temple's destruction. We are the beneficiaries of the rabbis' achievement and of the ways they responded to the questions. Their responses are so entrenched in the tradition as to blur the importance of the questions they answered. But mark my words, he says, Judaism was transformed. And the Judaism we live today, until the Holocaust, is really a set of answers to questions that arose with the destruction of the Second Temple, which was a continuation of the destruction of the first.
This also refers to the Bar Kokhba, not by name, the zealots that
had the Sakai. No, the zealots were the zealots.
Yeah, but he refers to Bar Kokhba and he says 135.
Bar Kokhba is 135, yeah.
So now we're skipping just one paragraph, and we're going to page 4, right-hand column, about 20 lines from the top. The Sadducees, especially the court nobility and the priests, could not envision Judaism without a temple. When they proved unable to rebuild the sanctuary in the decades following the year 70, the Sadducees could not cope with the Jewish people's situation and religious needs and so faded from the scene. If you don't adapt, you're out of here. Indeed, many Pharisees and rabbis shared the Sadducees' analysis and poured enormous efforts into trying to rebuild the temple. Some declared they would have no children, no celebrations. They would not allow no normal life until the temple is destroyed.
Restored.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry about that, guys. Although Rabbi Akiva reassured the Jews that even without the temple, it was possible to attain atonement directly for God, Rabbi Akiva innovated the idea that there could be Yom Kippur without the temple, that it still makes sense. He nevertheless gave all-out support to Bar Kokhba's desperate attempt to recapture independence and rebuild the holy sanctuary. Akiva went so far as to endorse Bar Kokhba as the Messiah. It was all in vain. The Romans were too powerful. Had the temple-centered view triumphed, the Jews would have put all their effort into regaining Jerusalem, a policy that would have spelled frustration, spiritual exhaustion, and finally, devastation. In other words, a few decades after the destruction of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the Jewish people had to reconcile ourselves to the fact that we'd have to go on with no temple or not go on.
Around the year 360, the Roman Emperor Julian wanted to restore the temple, but he found the Jewish support lukewarm at the time. The Jews had already we had already turned away from looking toward a rebuilding of the temple by our own hands.
Very good point. Very good point.
Interestingly enough, if you think of Israel as the temple, we are taking the position that was taken by these folks that he's saying devastation. So maybe we're at a point where we better start interpreting how to live in diaspora as opposed to being...
That's a very good point. I would personally say that a little bit different, but fundamentally, I personally agree. I would say it in the following fashion. With the creation of the State of Israel, the Jewish people have to interpret, we have to create a paradigm of understanding where are we going? And there's, so where are we going? There are certainly those in Israel whose paradigm says that we're going back to the period of the temple. Mm-hmm. We're going back to God directly in history. Whereas Rav Yitz will claim, we're not going back,
we're
going to a completely different new era. And it's really a fundamental question of where are we? What world are we living in? What world are we trying to create? Rav Yitz would claim that if we, quote unquote, misinterpret history now and understand it as a return to the previous times of temple times, we will probably be tremendously frustrated and devastated by history as it develops.
But historically, you think about what's happened in the diaspora, that you had 2,500 years of Jews living in the diaspora in the Muslim world, where you know there are none in the Muslim diaspora world now at this point in time. They all come back to Israel. So it's a historically significant thing. You know, whether it be Libya or Algeria or Morocco or Egypt, Jews lived there for 2,500 years, and now there are no Jews except for maybe 5,000 in Tunisia, and that's about it.
May I ask a question?
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
I can say it's a historical thing that has happened in our lifetime.
Absolutely.
And the same thing in Europe, where you had, you know, thousands of years of diaspora in Europe, and like in Poland, there's 5,000 Jews.
It's gone.
Instead of 3 million.
Let me just add to that, and then Aaron, relates to what Joe just said. Rav Yitz will always tell us, don't interpret the creation of the State of Israel as a revelational act in Jewish history without seeing it on the same screen as the Holocaust. If you look only at the State of Israel's creation, you might see a return to biblical times. But if you see it on the same screen as the Holocaust, you understand it cannot be understood as God's return to direct intervention in history because of the Holocaust. See them both as part of the same revelation.
What is the mechanism of preserving the alterations or the new course from the Second Temple to the Holocaust? Is that the creation of the Mishnah?
Yes, it's about the rabbinic reinterpretation. He's about to say.
Okay. Then the question comes up, is there a mechanism subsequent to the Holocaust and the State of Israel that will be like similar to that?
We don't know yet.
Very good. We don't know yet. But it has to do with the willingness to understand that the Holocaust and the Christian state together are revelational events that demand us to re-examine our thinking about God and our thinking about the world. That's why we're here, in this very room. Right?
He sure did pack a lot of thought-provoking information in 2 or 3 pages.
Yeah, he really did. Wow. It's amazing. You'll give me a copy of that, won't you?
Yeah. Okay, so we are on page 4, right-hand column, in the middle of the second paragraph. You know, we finished that second paragraph.
Yeah.
We finished it. So we got on to the third paragraph.
Another effect
of the destruction and exile was the increased exposure of Jews to the external culture. By destroying the major lodestone of Jewish life and through geographic dispersion, immersing more Jews in Greek culture, the destruction exposed Jews to the extraordinary magnetism of Hellenism. Hellenism was a cosmopolitan, sophisticated culture led by an affluent and pleasure-seeking elite that had already drawn many followers from the Jewish leadership. The loss of the Jewish land brought Hellenism to the masses as well. In fact, Jewry could not have maintained itself in the face of this competition but for the rabbis' development of a more learned and more internalized Jewish practice and value system. And remember, the prophets were on high. The prophets spoke from above. They spoke in the name of God, and it didn't penetrate the life of the Jews because it was a voice from a distance. The rabbis responded with what became the first public education system for adults. If the direct connection to the temple was lost, and it was, then Torah study would enable the Jews to internalize the teachings and values of God's way. This would allow them to confront the challenge of Hellenism and the more open society in which they lived following the dispersion. Study was glorified as the ultimate mitzvah in the saying, Talmud Torah equals them all. The Beit Knesset was made into the Beit Midrash. Opportunities for study were built into the services and the home liturgies. All aspects of life can be suffused with Jewish values and the meanings taught through actions and words. The rabbi's fundamental theological breakthrough was a kind of secularization insight. That's an important sentence he's going to flesh out. The manifest divine presence and activity was being reduced, but the covenant was actually being renewed. That's Rav Yitz's interpretation of the rabbi's interpretation. That prophecy has disappeared, divine intervention has disappeared, the temple with its presence of God has disappeared, but the covenant is not over. Right? The Sadducees basically said the covenant is over. There's no prophecy, there's no temple, there's no intervention in history, so there's no, for all intents and purposes, there's no God, there's no Judaism, we failed, close up shop. But the rabbi said that there's no prophecy, there's no intervention in history, and there's no temple, but that doesn't mean the covenant is being rejected, the covenant is being transformed. And the covenant now depends more on man and less on God. Remember he had said earlier that in the first temple period, I should say in the first cycle of Jewish history, that's exemplified by the Exodus, there's a covenant, which means a partnership, but God is the senior partner. In the second phase in Jewish history, man is the senior partner.
Well, it's like he's not in heaven. Love of Hashem.
Everyone understand what Chip just said? He connected what we just said to the story of the oven, which I did with you in other classes, perhaps not in this one. At the story of the oven, which the rabbis proclaim that God doesn't get involved in the adjudication of halakha. Adjudication of halakha. In other words, it's no longer prophecy, God telling us to do. It's us figuring out for ourselves, based on divine texts, what to do. Man becomes the senior partner in the covenant.
Well, maybe it's putting it another way. You have the disappearance or the replacement of the intermediaries with God, whether they be priests or whether they be prophets. And now it becomes, with rabbis as leaders, but it becomes a people's movement.
But it's not that now God speaks to every person. God speaks to no one.
No. Well, God. That's when Simpson starts, okay?
Where who starts?
Let it retract.
Mo is connecting what we're saying to the Kabbalistic metaphor. Right? And Mo is saying, Rav Yitz didn't say it, but it's good, that we can see here a second and more radical stage in the Tzimtzum that was necessary for creation. Remember, Tzimtzum means contraction. God had to contract himself to create the world. So Rav Yitz is saying that there was a second stage of contraction. When the second temple was destroyed, there's less godly presence in overt fashion, But that doesn't mean God is gone and God is dead.
God makes room for the people.
God makes room for the people, exactly. Which brings us to another metaphor that Rav Yitz didn't mention, but it's in the background, the metaphor of a child growing up. The metaphor of a child growing up, we've used that many times in this class, right? That in the biblical period, the Jewish people, perhaps we'd say humanity, but I'm not sure, the Jewish people are in the infancy, they have to hold God's hand. With the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jewish people are growing up, and we no longer need God's hand in order to walk through the continuation of our lives. How do we know that we're growing up? The destruction of the Second Temple is a signal we're growing up. That God no longer feels the need
or that we
to lead us.
Or that we had to grow up.
Good, good, good. That we have no choice but to grow up. Right. Right.
We moved out of our home. We're now on our own.
What happens in the recession? Kids move back to their homes, right?
So ultimately, in a person's life, the parent ultimately dies. Hopefully before the...
Chip said something very provocative there. You hear what he said?
No. Ultimately, in a child's life when he grows up, hopefully the parent ultimately dies before the child.
That's not part of the...
Not part of this.
What we're talking about here.
Another way to force someone to be on their own.
Yeah.
But you know what? Rav Yitz is going to quote someone he disagrees with Richard Rubinstein of God is Dead. Right?
After Auschwitz, yeah.
So as we see that for Rav Yitz, Jewish theology is an interpretation of ongoing history. Right? Okay, so now we are on page 5 at the top. And we started reading that paragraph of the Rabbi's Fundamental Theological Breakthrough. We'll read it again. The Rabbi's Fundamental Theological Breakthrough was a kind of secularization insight. The manifest divine presence and activity was being reduced, but the covenant was actually being renewed. God had not rejected the Jews, but rather had called them to a new stage of relationship and service. From where did the rabbis draw the authority to take charge of Jewish religion and destiny, to expand required observance in every area of life, to shape new institutions, and to legitimize the use of their minds and reason as the key source for deriving knowledge of what does the Lord require of thee? The unspoken, oft-used axiom is the unfolding of the covenantal model. Unfolding means the growing up, the development.
The opening up.
The opening up. The continuation, the growing. The Jewish people, the passive partner in the biblical covenant, is being urged to assume a new level of responsibility by its divine counterpart. Understand the destruction of the Second Temple as a divine move that urges us to assume a new level of responsibility. If Israel's phylacteries praise God as the Ahad, the unique one, it's God who also wears phylacteries which contain the praise of Israel, who is like your people Israel, one unique nation in the earth. That's a rabbinic midrash that says God wears tefillin. And what do God's tefillin say? God's tefillin praise the Jewish people. Now that's a strange midrash.
It's from the Milcha Shabbat prayer. Milcha Shabbat.
Very good. Very good. It doesn't say that the idea of tefillin, but the words are there.
Right.
And the truth is, I've always seen that midrash is anthropomorphic and off the wall and crazy, God wearing tefillin. But Rav Yitz explains what it means. It means that God looks to the Jewish people to take the lead. He wears tefillin that praise the Jewish people. He's looking up to them. As we look up to God, he's looking up to us. He's waiting for us to do something.
There's another way you can understand this. Carl Jung, the psychologist, thought that adulthood relationships go through a cycle of involvement and then withdrawal and then involvement again. And just like a you can look at it as the retraction, as the contraction of God following that same Jungian pattern, and then also you seem like Greenberg is following that in a sense being Jungian in God's relationship with the people, that he's involved and then he's withdrawn and then he's re-involved.
God is,
yes, and the people as well.
But Rav Yitz is never hoping for the return of God as parent. The other thinkers we've seen, right, we're hoping for that, right? Right, remember that? I emphasized many times.
As a co-partner?
Eliezer Berkowitz, right, and David Weiss Olivny, they don't see human freedom as leading anywhere but to another Holocaust. And they're hoping...
They're very pessimistic about human
Yes, nature. And they're hoping for an ultimate return of God that redeems us.
Return of God to history.
Return of God to history. Rav Yitz will not go down that road. He would see that, going back to what we talked about with Joe 5 minutes ago, as a regression. As a regression.
Interesting, the metaphor that we're using of parent and child grows up. They really get disturbed when the grandparents start getting back involved with their life. So Greenberg is saying the same thing.
Well, you know, he makes very distinct periods, but as I recall, in the Torah, God started receding quite a bit once they reached the promised land, and God wasn't always holding their hands saying, do, do, do. They'd go and do the wrong thing. And then during the period of kings, that was horrendous because most of the kings were horrible. God sent the prophets, of course, but God had already withdrawn quite a bit. Now, the
yes.
other thing, the next period of the rabbinic period coming upon the Hellenistic period, well, we could say that today, the Americanization
we certainly can.
Of the Jews, is it different from the Hellenization? Maybe not as extreme, but that period has not ended.
Rav Yitz will agree with you. He'll agree with both the things you said, right, that the withdrawal of God from history already began in the biblical period, but there was a jolt with the destruction of the Second Temple, and that cemented that withdrawal. And I'll also agree with you that the third period in Jewish history that we're now entering is a continuation of the same direction of the withdrawal of God and Jews on their own, more and more. Absolutely.
You make a comparison to what's happening in the United States as to what happened in Europe from the 1800s up until the 1930s, where the Jews became part of
assimilated,
and everything thought it was perfect until the 30s happened, and they found out throughout Europe they were not assimilated, accepted.
Yeah, I'm just going to add to what your idea is, not only in the United States and in Europe, it's all over the world, and now in Israel. So much secularization in Israel.
So much what?
You know?
Secularization.
Secularization.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there is just a small group of very religious people, but the rest of the people, Israel is a state. It's not anything to do with religion.
Yeah, but let's see how Rav Yitz interprets the historical phenomena that you're seeing. He has an interesting interpretation of that.
But I want to point out to everybody that the demographics are what is determining what's happening to the Jewish population, because of the assimilated groups are intermarrying and have few children and are not considering themselves Jewish. And the Orthodox are the ones that, by demographics in Israel and the United States, 50 to 60% of the Jewish children are from the Orthodox. And that's what's going to happen in the United States.
And the rest of the world where they have, in my country, Venezuela, when I grew up, it was very secular in a way, you know, there was a tradition. But now there is all Kabbalists there and all the
ultra-religion. Right. That's a different subject.
A different subject, but what you're saying
yes.
is reviving.
Yes, it's true in Israel and the U.S. It's also true in Dallas, Texas, by the way.
Sure, I know. I've been here for 40-some years. It was
not. Okay. Let's go on. We're beginning, we read that second paragraph. There's one line left in that second paragraph at the top of page 5 on the left. There's one line left. The divine partner becomes more restrained, more hidden, more intimate in relationship to the Jews.
More intimate. More
intimate.
Personal God, right?
I'm not sure, because on the that word intimate, I'm not sure what he means here, because he could mean, in the sense of intimacy, means hidden, means behind closed doors.
Private.
They could also be hinting to something else he's saying, that as God becomes more distant, but the sense of God becomes more diffuse. Let me wait for him to say that, because I'm not sure he's saying it here. Okay, let's wait for him.
In a way, it sounds like what somebody said about how you know, we don't know prophets and all to communicate with God, we sort of ourselves.
Yes, exactly. That's what Rav Yitz is about to say. Tell me, actually, if this makes sense to you. Children growing up in their parents' house hear their parents' voice all the time. But it's a distant voice. It's from a different generation. And they do everything in their power to block out that voice. When kids grow up, they become more distant geographically from their parents. They're not living in the same house, sometimes in a different city. The children take on more responsibility. But paradoxically, they end up very often incorporating the insights of their parents' voice more into their own daily lives, as they reflect on their childhood, and they tend to develop a certain respect from a distance for their parents. Not always. Reminds us of the famous statement of Mark Twain, who said something like, when I was 18, I was amazed by the stupidity of my parents. When I reached the age of 20, it was surprising how much they had learned in 2 years. Right? So what I'm trying to say with that metaphor is that when children get older, the parents become more distant, and the children become more independent, but at the same time, the parents' values tend to become more absorbed.
They internalize.
That's exactly what Rav Yitz is saying here. That the rabbis allowed and even encouraged God's distance, but at the same time, that distance is exactly what allows the internalization of the values that the prophets never managed to teach us. The prophets were too parental.
It's a different kind of closeness.
A different type of closeness. Yeah. 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 In the biblical period, God's presence was manifest by splitting the Red Sea and drowning the Egyptians. In the Second Temple siege, God did not show up like the cavalry in the last scene of a Western movie to save the day. God had, as it were, withdrawn, become more hidden, so as to give humans more freedom, and to call the Jews more responsible partnership in the covenant. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said that God's might, shown in biblical times by destroying the wicked, is now manifest in divine self-control. The ethics of the Father says, who is mighty who exercises same self-restraint? Ezu gibor kovesh et yitzro. God allows the wicked to act without being cut off immediately. The great biblical praise of God is great, mighty, and awesome, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanara, found in Deuteronomy, is used as the model of divine praise for the opening of the central rabbinic prayer, the Amidah, the standing silent prayer, but the meaning is reversed. God's might is expressed in allowing human freedom instead of punishing the wicked. He's referring now to a midrash that was the centerpiece of Eliezer Berkowitz's book. Like the midrash that said, if you remember, that Jeremiah saw the heathens entering the first temple, destroying it, and he said, where is God? And he could no longer say God, the great, mighty, and awesome, and he removed one of those words. He removed the word awesome. And then came Daniel a few 100 years later and said, we're in exile, where is God? And he had to take away not only the word awesome, also the word mighty. And then came the men of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, with the rebuilding of the Second Temple, and said, "Pum prakert." On the contrary, God's greatness and His might and His awesome deeds are in the fact that He manages to restrain Himself and not intervene. And they constituted the Amidah prayer with us saying those words, Hakel Hagadol Gibor Vanara, but the meaning now is the opposite of what was meant in the Bible. It means God was the power to restrain Himself. So for Eliezer Berkowitz, that was the center of his book. Rav Yitz is going the same direction, but Rav Yitz turns it into a progression. Eliezer Berkowitz saw it as a basically one-time thing, that God contracted Himself, and we have to live with it. And as we said earlier, Eliezer Berkowitz is hoping for the day that God returns. Whereas Rav Yitz sees it as a process of the parent-child relationship maturing. And we're not going to be hoping for a turn to infancy. Although the central biblical idea of covenant implies a treaty between two sides, nowhere in the Bible is the term partner or partnership used. Divine intervention is so overwhelming, that's in the Bible, that the term partnership is hardly appropriate. One of the rabbi's most powerful ideas is that the people Israel and the individual Jew become partners of God through religious activity. He who prays on the eve of Sabbath and chants Vayichulu in the Kiddush becomes, as it were, a partner to the Holy One, blessed be He, in the work of creation. A judge who gives true judgment and who observes the holy days become partners with God. What he means is that in the early periods of Jewish history, we understood our partnership with God to be very passive. All we had to do was say that God is a creator and give witness to the fact that He's a creator. That's our role in the partnership. Whereas times advance and our role in the partnership becomes more and more active and central. A world in which God is more hidden is a more secular world. Right? That's obvious, right? It's a more secular world, but according to what we're reading, it's the world that God wants. It's more secular, but it's still a religious world. And perhaps, as Rav Yitz will say, we have to stop using the word secular or reinterpret it, because secular becomes God's will. God wants the world to be more secular. But that's God, that's religious, that's not secular.
Yeah, it depends on what secular means. Right? But there's another question. This assumes that God is the one who determines that the Jews should become more secular. I would argue that it's the rabbis who realize the necessity. The rabbis and maybe the Pharisees recognize the necessity for that because of what was happening historically.
Yes.
It becomes the initiative of the people, as it were.
Right. That's the first line of the essay, that Judaism is a midrash in history. Right? It's not that God came and said, you're growing up now. Not with words. But we're interpreting, and history is telling us that that's what God is saying. But it's our interpretation. Mo is right. We could have interpreted differently.
It's our decision.
Of how to interpret.
Yeah, the 10 tribes of Israel just flat out disappeared.
Yep.
We were assimilated and gone.
So if you look at what's happened in the last 2,000 years as far as the Jews, you're either going to say God has disappeared, God has withdrawn, God doesn't care, because, you're ignoring what the rest of the world has done to the Jews through the last 2,000 years and continues to do so. You can make this very definite comparison between the Markovka Revolt and what happened, and the State of Israel, which basically puts all the Jews in one place so the rest of the world can put all their hate and orient itself to one specific place. And the same thing that happened to Bar Kokhba Revolt.
Can happen.
It can happen. And, you know, there's no question, based upon what happened in the UN and what the reaction to the... you know, to Israel defending itself, and you see the condemnation of the rest of the world, and it's just scary as what's happening out there. And you know, you just tend to think that either God doesn't exist, or God is dead, or God doesn't care.
Or what we're reading here. But as Mo just said, and as Jim just said, it's a matter of interpretation, right? Revelation has to be interpreted. Revelation has to be interpreted. Okay. A world in which God is more hidden is a more secular world. Paradoxically, this secularization makes possible the emergence of the synagogue as a central place of Jewish worship. In the temple, God was manifest. So what do you need synagogues for? Visible holiness was concentrated in one place. A more hidden God, that is to say, the God that comes after the Second Temple destruction, can be encountered everywhere, but one must look and find. And I read that in light of the metaphor of parents. Grown children can encounter their parents everywhere, in the sense that everything that happens, you can ask yourself, what would my parents' values be in this place? And you don't ask that question when you live in your parents' house, because you just want to
get out.
The visible presence of God in the temple gave a sacramental quality to the cultic life of the sanctuary. Through the high priest's ministrations and the scapegoat ceremony, the national sins were forgiven and a year of rain and prosperity assured. In the synagogue, the community's prayers are more powerful and elaborate than the individual's, but the primary effect grows out of the individual's own merits and effect. One may enter the synagogue at all times without the elaborate purification required for temple entrance, because sacredness is more shielded in the synagogue. In the temple era, God spoke directly through prophecy or through the Urim and Tumim breastplate. In the synagogue, God does not speak. The human-divine dialogue goes on through human address to God. Because God does not speak, so man has to become active as a searcher and as a speaker to God, with God. Prayer, which we today view as a visibly sacred activity, was, by contrast with the temple service, a secular activity. Yeah, right? If you could go to the temple and feel God's presence, mm-hmm. then to stay at home and pray is a relatively secular activity. Prayer became the central religious act because of the silence of God.
What about study? It's even more central than prayer.
Right. And study is a secular activity when you have the possibility of hearing prophecy. When you have no prophecy, then study can become a religious activity. A classical expression of the broadening and diffusion of holiness is the rabbinic application of temple purity standards to the home and to other non-sacred settings, a process that began before the destruction of the temple. Here we can... we don't have to read the rest of it. He just has examples of bringing... sanctity to the home through the transfer of temple rituals to the home. I'm going to read the top of page 6, about the 10th line. The rabbis were a more secular leadership than priests or prophets. Priests were born to holiness and were bound to ritually circumscribed lives. The rabbis won their status through learning and were not bound to sacramental requirements different from the average Jew. Prophets spoke the unmediated word of God. Thus says the Lord, Ko amar Hashem. By contrast, the rabbis judged what God asks of us by the best exercise of his judgment. It's in the singular. The rabbi judged what God asks of us by the best exercise of his judgment, guided by his knowledge of the past record of God's instruction, the biblical models, and the legal precedents. The rabbi stated that prophecy had ended with the destruction and the exile. And Joe, that means the destruction of the first temple. He didn't say that clearly. What the rabbis really meant then... No, I skipped something. Okay. In fact, however, biblical prophets such as Ezekiel had prophesied during the Babylonian exile. What the rabbis really meant then was prescriptive. After the second temple, there can be no prophecy. He just said something very powerful. He just said that it's not merely that with the destruction of the first temple and the exile, it's not merely that prophecy ended in a metaphysical sense. And the rabbi said, ah, we see prophecy ended. No, it was much more nuanced. The rabbis saw certain signs that prophecy was ending, and then the rabbis proscribed, prophecy has ended. If anyone today thinks they're a prophet, you're not.
That's because they heard that their prophet, because they heard it themselves from God, so they were themselves claiming prophecy.
Okay.
To be able to judge one way or the other.
But it's not that simple, right? Right. It's not just that God put an end to prophecy. The Jewish people put an end to prophecy. In that they interpreted that there are no more prophets. That they understood the divine signs, but they could have. Do you think that there were no more people saying there were prophets? Of course there were. In the second temple, you don't think there were people that said, God spoke to me? The rabbi said, no, he didn't.
And the people today claim they're prophets.
Yes.
Why can't we call Herschel a prophet?
Why can't we? Because Jewish tradition has decided that there's no more prophecy. We can call him a prophet in a metaphorical sense, but what we really mean is that he's a rabbi. He's a scholar. He's an interpreter of text and of reality. But we don't mean that God spoke to him directly.
Yes, we do, but he saw what was going to happen to European Jewry.
Good, good, good. But that's not called prophecy in the literal, classical sense.
It was clairvoyant then.
Insight.
So, we're reading a little bit more. Where are we? Right. We ended when I got up from my chair in the middle of this.
The rabbis.
The rabbi stated that prophecy had ended with the destruction of the exile. In fact, however, biblical prophets such as Ezekiel had prophesied during the Babylonian exile. What the rabbis really meant then was prescriptive. They prescribed. They made a statement of how we will interpret reality. After the second destruction, there can be no prophecy. He says after the second destruction now. And so the whole period from the destruction of the first to the destruction of the temple
is the waning of prophecy.
Is the waning of prophecy. It's the development of a new interpretation that there will be no prophecy, but it takes hundreds of years. Like I told you earlier, an hour ago, if you read in the book of the Maccabees are waiting when the Maccabees reconquer the temple, are in the process of consecrating the altar and the menorah. They're waiting for a voice from heaven. It says explicitly, they don't know what to do. And actually, Rav Yitz, in his book about the holidays, interprets the book of Maccabees that there was a 3-year period in which they didn't do anything, waiting to see what God would do. And one camp said, if God doesn't do anything, that proves that our rebellion was misguided. But the Maccabees decided not so. That was a tremendous statement, that we can move forward and have a certain degree of confidence that we're not in the wrong, even though there's no prophetic voice proclaiming that what we did is right. By the way, now I have to put a pinprick in the bubble, in the balloon. What is the story, the later story, found in the Talmud, of the miracle of the oil? It lasts for 8 days, but an effort to reintroduce God's direct hand into history.
Also,
it doesn't mean say one. So, in other words, you could see that story of the miracle of the oil as a regression.
Another regression would be that during the Maccabean period, supposedly the book of Daniel was written.
That late?
Yeah. It was. I mean, this is because it was written to give comfort to the people.
I don't know anything about that.
We'll talk about it.
So let's just read three more lines and we should end, I guess. If God has withdrawn, then prophecy is inappropriate. Prophecy is the communicative counterpart of splitting the Red Sea, and that's no longer. Rabbinic guidance is the theological counterpart of a hidden God. If God is becoming hidden, then the rabbis have to take the place of God in a certain sense. To use a different metaphor, if the parent is moving, is becoming more distant, then the child has to make decisions on his own based on the values he got from his parent.
The thing that I find that would be, I wouldn't say a flaw in this argument, but certainly allowing the argument to be consistent, is the question, what do we need God for at all for this model not to still be perfect? In other words, you can draw a line wherever you want to at the destruction of the Second Temple, for example. Just draw that line. And then if all of this is evolving and going on its own, and God is so withdrawn then that he is withdrawn to nothingness, so what do we need God for at all for this model that is just going to continue on, still recalling the message of the metaphor of the parents' teachings and so forth, and that's what we're supposed to do, and even with the rabbinic reminders of that's what we're supposed to do and we're to evolve. So what do we need God for in this model?
I want to try and understand the question better. You're not saying what do we need the idea of God for at all, but what do we need him for in the present?
Well, I'm saying that you can believe that God existed, interacted, yes, was responsive, mm-hmm, and all of those things that we know that God did, mm-hmm, put it up to the destruction of the second temple. But since that time, since he is so withdrawn, I mean, yes, he is so withdrawn, he's withdrawn to an infinitesimal,
right,
thing,
yes,
only an idea, a historical,
right,
idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a presence now for which we can pray to. I mean, that's another issue, mm-hmm, but expect ever any kind of guidance other than the guidance that was bestowed prior to the second temple.
Yeah. I think that's a very good question.
I think it's great. We should start with that next week.
but I'll forget. Just let me say one little thing. It's not.
Jay will not.
Do you want to take the shumstephen?
Perhaps one answer is we need God for the conviction, mm-hmm, that our efforts in moving towards redemption are necessary.
Okay, but Jay is saying God's saying you're on your own now,
yep,
guys.
Right.
The argument that we had, but the argument that we studied before, that the proof that God is still there is the creation of the state of Israel, and that the Jewish people have survived despite everything, is to me a more convincing argument of the presence of God than this viewpoint that he is so withdrawn that you could hardly detect he was ever there.
And he allowed the Holocaust to happen.
I think maybe there's a distinction. It's not he's withdrawn, he's just hidden. His presence is still here, but it's hidden. As opposed to being withdrawn from the world, he's still in the world, but hidden.
but there's no God that would exist to allow the Holocaust.
You know, his hiddenness is, you know, I guess his presence shows up with the, like, the creation of the State of Israel and his continued survival.
We're not going anymore Friday night.
Well, I mean, we cannot attribute in this viewpoint that the creation of the State of Israel has anything to do with God because he's so hidden. It is the evolution that was started in the ball rolling, you might say, the momentum created it by man, not by God's intervention.
By man, inspired by God's ideals, but
exactly,
man.
Exactly, by an idea, by...
You know,
I hear. Ask it again next week and the week after.
Yes, Greenberg and Leonard Fine years ago in the debate. The point was that Israel was founded by secularists.
Yeah. Thank you, Rabbi.